Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell was introducing the idea of dehumanizing as we speak with Iris Chang. You've written two books that it would seem to me would be hard to write and sometimes are hard to read, both The Rape of Nanking and The Chinese in America, and this business about coming to terms with these very basic human interactions, whether it's xenophobia or fear of the unknown or dealing with economic turmoil. Aren't these hard books to write?
Oh, all of them are difficult emotionally to write. I have written three books, Thread of the Silkworm, The Chinese in America, and also The Rape of Nanking. But they all have the same kinds of themes in common, the themes of power, the themes of human rights abuses and injustice. And I began to see a pattern emerging as I wrote these books, and I realized that all three books actually sometimes describe some of the factors that lead to these either genocidal acts or mass murder, and it's interesting to see how often it's a three-step process that precedes genocide. That often it's triggered by first an economic depression, then secondly some kind of political dictatorship, and then thirdly ethnic scapegoating, when one group is just demonized in the media and held responsible for all the social problems. And we see this, with The Rape of Nanking, these were some of the conditions in Japan that led to the invasion of China, which ultimately killed 35 million Chinese. But we've seen this happen in other countries as well, in Germany before the Holocaust. We've seen this precede the Armenian genocide. And we even see it in our own country. And I mentioned this in The Chinese in America.
You talk about in the 1880s, which certainly wasn't in my history books, that with exclusion acts and essentially the support of the political power of the government, that we engaged in a modest, at least on scale, simply because there weren't that many people, but particularly in the West, a little genocide of our own.
You mean in America?
In America.
They called it the driving out period. And it's really shocking when you consider that before this happened, the Chinese were actually very well treated in this country. Interracial marriage rates between Chinese men and white women were pretty high. They were very well respected when the country was prosperous, and some became extremely wealthy, as capitalists across the country. But in the 1870s, there was a severe economic depression that hit this country, and all of a sudden, the Chinese found themselves competing for jobs with Civil War veterans, new European immigrants. A lot of people were out of work, and the Chinese capitalists and the Chinese laborers were often able to work more efficiently than many of the other groups. So that's when a political movement started, when it mobilized to try to shut the Chinese out of the country. This is what eventually led to the Chinese Exclusion Act, which, of course, barred Chinese laborers from coming to the U.S. for the next 60 years.
That was after we got the railroads built.
Yes, that's right. Very convenient.
There are a lot of folks who, I think, hold on to the old stereotype that, well, the Chinese came to build the railroads. And it's wonderful to watch you say, well, yes, many Chinese came and many Chinese did help build the railroads. And that's not the story at all.
There are so many other contributions that we don't even think of. For example, there are contributions to civil rights law in this country.
Now, that is not obvious.
That's not obvious. But our right to U.S. Birthright citizenship was pretty much safeguarded by a Chinese-American lawsuit, Wong Kim Ark versus U.S. It's a very important ruling. It would prevent people in this country from being relegated into a permanent foreign underclass. But everybody now who's born in the United States is a U.S. citizen, whether their ancestors were citizens or not. And there are so many other contributions that the Chinese have made in this country that really aren't discussed in a lot of textbooks.
There was a little piece of that. I may not have the details right, but at one point in San Francisco, which I think of as a fairly progressive city, there were separate schools. This was before Plessy versus Ferguson.
Good old-fashioned segregation.
And actually after, now that I think about it. But they had white schools, and then they very overtly had schools for African Americans and Native Americans, and the Chinese didn't fit anywhere, so they didn't have any schools at all, which is part of the driver behind some of these civil rights cases, because the Chinese, at least some, didn't take it lying down.
And they fought back, and they sued the school systems, in some parts of the country, the Chinese were shut out of the school system intentionally because they met with hostility there. That actually the worst racism was in California, but in other parts, for example, like in the American South, the experience was a little more favorable, and sometimes they would be permitted to attend white schools if no one complained. But as my book mentions, in the Chinese American, when a Chinese American boy became valedictorian, if his high school class, some of the whites, parents in that community, organized to shut all the Chinese out of the school. So there are some examples of real vindictiveness and envy and nastiness that hurt the Chinese. But there was so much that they did to help this country. For example, during World War II, I didn't realize when I researched this book that 1 in 5 Chinese Americans served in the armed forces during World War II.
Which is phenomenal.
Phenomenal. I don't think there was a higher percentage of contribution and service for any other ethnic group.
It's possible the African Americans did, and I would have to go look at the numbers.
It's a very large number among the African American community as well. And part of that with all minorities in America was to try to prove that they were just as American as everybody else. And to themselves, that certainly worked. I'm not sure it worked as well to the rest of the country. They said, well, sure, you can go fight and die, but after it's over, you come back to second-class citizenship, which then people were less willing to accept.
Yes, and it is very unfortunate that to this day, when we go into a Hollywood film, or when we look at some of these retrospectives on World War II, when we see an Asian face in a World War II uniform, it's usually the image of a Japanese enemy soldier, or maybe a Chinese foreign national who's fighting for the Chinese military. But we don't see many Chinese Americans in American uniform. And that's a very important part of our American legacy that we're neglecting.
Part of what was interesting about your book, there's a tendency to assume this is all over and done with, that, you know, the genocides have gone away, that
everything's perfect from here on forward.
Well, I was born and then lived happily ever after, or something.
Something like that.
And it just keeps coming back and coming back, not just in this country, certainly. It's a problem. It seems to be a human problem. But in this country, we at least have a little more, we have more responsibility here. And it just keeps coming back and coming back and coming back. And you tell stories, bring this. Because, frankly, I was reading along and said, okay, you know, we're in the early 1800s, and, you know, I can understand this. And then we get to after the Civil War, and, well, they had some problems then. But now we get up, fast forward, to 1990s, and we're still going through these same kinds of stereotypical behaviors.
And, of course, transgressions against our civil liberties. That's why the final chapter of my book, The Chinese in America, is called An Uncertain Future. And the whole theme and premise of my book is really that our American democracy is still very much a young and fragile experiment. And every generation of Americans, not just Chinese Americans, have had to struggle for their rights and freedoms and civil liberties in this country. And it's an ongoing struggle. And it has to be continued by our descendants and their descendants. Otherwise, our republic can't survive.
And it's not just minorities. I mean, I think those of us who are not obvious minorities, though I think we all are part of some minority. It's just, you know, pick your favorite. Some are more abused than others. But we all, you know, we tend to want to take it for granted. We tend to want to believe the grammar school version of American history and that we have democracy and we're going to live happily ever after.
Or we're going to impose it on other countries.
Well, and oh, by the way, since we've perfected it, we should share it with all those.
Force it in down the throats of.
That's not how a true grassroots democracy works, ever.
I was speaking, as I was reading The Chinese in America, I had a conversation with a young friend of mine who's probably early 30s, who's a Japanese American. And I said to her that it was interesting to be thinking newly about how very different the experience is of various Asian Americans, and it makes a difference if someone is Japanese American, Korean American, Chinese
Absolutely.
American, Taiwanese American. That while that we sort of have come in these days to say, oh, well, Asian. No. These are dramatically different experiences.
Well, the category is Asian Pacific Islander. I mean, that's what the Census Bureau has given us for.
And there's often a drive within the Asian American community to try to, to bring the community together, to try to dissolve differences. But the reality is, of course, the histories are all very different and unique. And
They're different there as well as different here.
That's right. And, of course, during World War II, the Japanese American population suffered terribly by being interned, and the Chinese Americans benefited. And it's unfortunate many of them chose to wear "I am Chinese" buttons to distinguish themselves from the Japanese Americans when they really should have been protesting and trying to help protect the civil liberties of the Japanese Americans. I keep reminding my readers that anytime any laws pass that's going to hurt a particular ethnic group, even if it's not yours, even if it's an unpopular minority group or a fringe group, it's going to hurt all of us.
I came across, there's a sentence in there that I'll talk about when we come back.
He's seeing the anxious look. Let's return in a moment with Iris Chang. She has written about the Chinese in America. She's done that. She's also written about other experiences within the Chinese American and Chinese Japanese experiences. She's written widely, and will be with us when we return in a moment. Please be with us.